Welcome, everybody, to Crystal Kyle and Friends. Today, we're going to be talking to Motaz Salem. He's a Palestinian, and he has been getting directly in the face of various congresspeople who are voting to send more money and weapons to Israel. He's lost a lot of family members, right?
100.
He lost 100 family members?
100 family members in Gaza. Yeah, he's Palestinian-American. He's lost 100. I don't even know 100 family members. Like, I can't even begin to wrap my mind around that level of loss. So he has channeled that in the best way that he possibly can figure out to do, which is to be on Capitol Hill practically every day alongside Medea Benjamin, who we interviewed last week, and others, and just stalking these congresspeople and, you know, confronting them basically with his humanity.
He's doing the Lord's work. It doesn't take much of, like, pressure from him or Medea for them to just go like, I'm a Nazi. I really love Nazism.
Yeah, they really reveal themselves.
That's right. Yeah, it is crazy. So anyway, we're going to talk to him. We got a lot of the clips of the stuff that he did in the halls of Congress. We'll get his reaction. We'll get his backstory, all that fun stuff. So for everybody just watching this, if you're not signed up to Crystal Kyle and Friends, do yourself a big favor. The Substack link is below. Go sign up for Crystal Kyle and Friends. You could sign up for $5 a month. You get the video of the interview and you get it immediately. Or you could sign up for free and get the audio podcast delivered right to your email inbox a day later when it drops. So definitely check that out. But before we go any further, there was a wee bit of a debate yesterday that actually Sagar was the moderator for.
Yeah, he did a great job.
Yeah, so it's a zero hedge debate. And the debate was on Israel and Palestine and whether or not what Israel is doing is genocide. And it was Dave Smith and Cenk Uygur versus Dennis Prager and Batya Unger Sargon. And thoughts up front. Let's just get your thoughts up front before we cut to the clips.
Well, a high level thought, just like a meta thought, is it's too many people. The one-on-one debates really work better because there's just too much crosstalk and you got four strong personalities and you can never really drill down on any one particular point. So that's meta. But I mean, listen, I actually thought Dave Smith did phenomenal. He has incredible, like, background. He was able to put things in a way that left Dennis Prager at times literally stumbling, like, sort of, like, sputtering and unable to recover. Cenk always does a fantastic job. They were a good duo because Cenk, you know, comes in really hot. Dave comes in with, like, all this historical background. Sagar made an interesting point this morning on Breaking Points when we were talking about it. And he's like, you know, it was very notable to him that the pro-Israel side really wanted to keep everything focused basically on October 7th, but certainly nothing before October 7th. And the pro-Palestinian side was talking much more about, we got to talk about, you know, October 7th doesn't come out of nowhere. This isn't, you know, existing in a vacuum. We got to talk about all the atrocities we've been having up after all of the years. And the other thing that is very noteworthy is just at times the requirement of outright denial of reality at this point. Given what we've all seen, given what we all know about the targeting and, you know, the where's daddy targeting of civilians, the reasonable grounds and plausible genocide, the starvation of the entire population, the destruction of literally everything in sight. At this point, to defend all of that and say this is still stick by, like, this is the most moral army on the planet. It's just sort of a fascinating exercise to watch how you can even make that claim at this point and what it requires to make that claim at this point.
Yeah, we got to get, I'd like to have Dave Smith on the show because he's a libertarian. So I would have a love-hate relationship with him on about half the issues. I'd be like, are you out of your fucking mind?
Yeah.
But then on the other half the issues, I'd be like, hey man, great point. I agree.
Yeah. So there was actually a funny moment where Dave was like, I don't really want to quibble over whether the term is genocide or not.
We actually have that clip. It's part of a longer clip that we got.
And, you know, Cenk is obviously making the case for genocide, and Prager comes in and is like, well, your debate partner doesn't even agree that it's genocide. And he's like, he's a libertarian. I'm a progressive. Like, we disagree on many, many things. And I think Dave replies like, yeah, and this is so bad that we actually agree on this. That's how bad this is.
Yeah, so I agree. I think Cenk and Dave did a great job, and Dennis Prager is the most annoying man on the planet. And Batya seems like a very nice person, but was making some pretty bad arguments, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So let's cut. Okay, we could have spent literally like 3 hours breaking this debate down. So we had to sort of narrow it down as much as humanly possible here. But I have two clips for you. Let's start with this one.
They're not being targeted because they're Muslims or Arabs or Palestinians. They're being targeted because Hamas has embedded itself within a civilian population, right? None of us would accept, I hope, that if they had only killed let's say, 6,000 Hamas terrorists, that that would be a genocide, right? We would understand that that was a military campaign to rid Israel of a danger threatening to its civilians. These people who have been killed as a result of Israel's attempt to eradicate Hamas. And so to suggest that they are being targeted because of their race or ethnicity, I mean, we don't believe that. We know that that's not the case. We know that if they were Palestinians living in Israel or living in Jordan, Israel would not be committing, they would not be dying as a result of Israel's actions. And furthermore, you can point to all of the ways in which Israel has tried to move the civilian population out of the way. They moved 1 million people out of northern Gaza into Khan Yunis and into Rafah and into southern Gaza to get them out of the way. Now, I see you smiling. You're probably thinking to yourself, oh, she's proving my point. It's ethnic cleansing. But here's the point. I mean, it's either the ethnic cleansing charge and the genocide charge are a little bit contradictory, right? Okay. Because if they were trying to commit a genocide and could just simply eradicate the world of Gaza's Muslim population, surely they would not be moving civilians out of harm's way while they're trying to get rid of the presence of Hamas in a certain place or not.
Are you saying that it is more akin to an ethnic cleansing or it's not a genocide?
I think it's really funny to both claim that Israel doesn't do enough to protect civilians and then to use a word like ethnic cleansing, like a nasty, accusatory, racist word, when they actually tried to suggest they're doing something racist when they tried to protect the civilian lives of the people living in northern Gaza.
I want to get Dave. Because you dominated last time, so Dave, you're up.
Okay, look, I want to just say that in terms of the charge of genocide, I don't use the word genocide. I just think that the debate devolves into semantics every time you use it. The international legal definition of genocide is so incredibly vague that it's like if you try to destroy a nationality or ethnicity in whole or part. So then, like, if you were to, like, murder two people of an ethnicity, is that a... I just don't even care about the debate. I'm saying it's wrong. And in terms of, like, the term ethnic cleansing, there is no debate. Every single new historian in Israel concludes that there was ethnic cleansing at the beginning of the creation of Israel. I'm just making that point.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to revisit something here because I literally just made what I feel is the most important point of all of this about that I think the entire Israeli defense is destroyed when you add in the component that they intentionally propped up Hamas so that the Palestinians wouldn't get their freedom. And as a response, Mr. Prager invokes an atrocity that happened once. And like, okay, that was an atrocity.
Let me just finish. Atrocities.
Yes, I know
we
you can invoke
spend a... the rest of the day or evening.
Yes, okay, can I just finish?
Non-Hamas Palestinian atrocities.
What happened to Deir Yassin? You want
Deir
to have a
Yassin was 1948.
So what? Okay,
there is
so
no
what?
War in the history of the world
So it's a cop out.
I'm acknowledging Deir Yassin was awful.
Okay, so
that's
by the way, hold on. Let me just finish my sentence, and then you guys can continue.
So it proves what?
Right, exactly. It proves nothing. My point is,
why did you make it?
Because I'm mirroring how your point proves nothing. You're just dodging the point that I was making about this current war. Yes, it's objectively true. There have been horrific, ungodly atrocities committed by both sides.
Not both sides. That's a lie.
Come on.
That is a libel.
It is
not true.
Oh, it's a libel. Okay.
Other than Deir Yassin, which was during wartime of a village and absolutely terrible, tell me where there's been Israeli atrocities comparable to Palestinian atrocities. Go ahead. Everybody quiet. Name it. Or you libeled.
So the one I said doesn't count. Why?
I love how he thinks that's like a real gotcha point, like to put you on the spot, like name one Israeli atrocity. The problem,
homie, how much time you got?
The problem in responding to that is there's such a list that it's like, where do I even begin?
So right off the top of my head, and this is just in the recent genocide of Gaza, right? I'm not including 2014 Operation Protective Edge. I'm not talking about the Nakba. I'm not just recently, right off the top of my head, when I first heard this, the multiple flower massacres. Multiple. Mm-hmm. There wasn't one. There was multiple instances where people were going desperately trying to get food and they got murked. The story of Hind that you famously covered. Mm-hmm. This poor little girl stuck in the car gets murked by Israel.
And her would-be rescuers also targeted and murdered by Israel.
But name one atrocity, though. You haven't named an atrocity. 13 kids killed outside of Al-Shifa Hospital. This is something that EuroMedMonitor, the human rights group, brought out in excruciating detail, where you know all these 13 kids and what happened to them. The drone strike on unarmed young men walking on a dirt road where there was no weapons around. There was no nothing around. They're walking on a dirt road and a drone takes them out from the sky when they weren't a threat to anybody at all. Bombing a refugee camp and killing hundreds of civilians to get one Hamas member, which is what the IDF said. That was their story. They went on CNN and said, yeah, we killed hundreds of civilians to get one Hamas member. We have the multiple civilians who were waving white flags who Israel gunned down. That was a very famous story because it turned out some of them, maybe even all of them, happened to be Israeli. The starving of millions of Palestinians. This is the medieval siege. No food, no fuel, no water, no electricity. There's 30,000 Hamas members. There's 2.3 million people in Gaza. They announced a policy of collective punishment. And then they turn on, name one atrocity. Every single day is a fucking atrocity, you absolute scumbag. The bombing of over, there were over 20 hospitals bombed in Gaza. Remember when everybody was arguing over which one was it? It wasn't Al-Shifa. It was Al-Ali. I think it was Al-Ali.
You know,
it was a misfired Palestinian rocket. No, it wasn't. People were arguing over that. And then fast forward 3 months and over 20 hospitals in Gaza have been bombed. They're doing controlled demolitions of every single school in Gaza. And this guy has the nerve to say, name one atrocity. They bombed fucking UN buildings, you psychopath. UN buildings. By the way, one of those UN buildings was a standalone building. They don't even have the argument of like, well, next door was a Hamas stronghold or something. Then they, what do they go to? The UN is Hamas. Like, this is...
Yeah.
This is psychotic. You libeled.
We just had an entire news cycle about Israel targeting and assassinating seven World Central Kitchen aid workers.
That's right.
Like,
I didn't remember that one.
We just had a whole thing about that. And you're like, name one atrocity. Just this week, they murdered 11 children playing on a playground in Rafah, a temporary playground that had been built for these displaced children that were murdered. I mean, IDF soldiers are TikToking atrocities on a near daily basis. And so it makes your head explode. When someone says something like that, it's like, do you actually believe this? Are you in such a bubble that none of this is penetrating for you? And I think it really is, to me, the most devastating point. There's two of them. Number one, they announced a complete siege. So you're like, they're not targeting civilians. There's no atrocities. How do you get around the fact that they're intentionally starving the entire population? Like, they are starving the entire population. Definitionally, you must think at least one. I actually don't think that they do, but theoretically, you must think at least one of those people is innocent and not Hamas, right? But they really ascribe to Israel nothing but good intentions. So even when it seems undeniable, first there's all the spin of like, oh, well, even saying that is a libel, you know, and you know he wants to say blood libel.
Yeah, to be anti-Semite.
He knew he couldn't quite get away with that.
Right.
So he just calls it a libel, which no one would.
That's not a thing.
Right. No one would say in any other context. So we know you're smearing these accusations. You're saying they're anti-Semitic when we're all watching this unfold before our eyes. So that's the first go-to is like, this is anti-Semitic, or actually the source for it is Hamas because it's the UN, or it's, you know, even when Joe Biden says something critical, like, oh, he's doing Hamas talking points.
Ben
or
Shapiro
whatever.
Said that. He said that.
Or, you know, they'll lie too about the death statistics. That's actually one of the clips that we have of Motaz confronting Marco Rubio. Like, oh, well, these death statistics, they're not even real. This is from the Hamas
Batya does that in this debate too.
Gaza Health Ministry, etc. So first is the attempt to deny, excuse, assume the very best of intentions. If you get them dead to rights on some sort of atrocity, it's never intentional. It's always, well, they're really trying, but it's accidental. War is hell. It's accidental. Whereas when it's a Palestinian, when it's Hamas, everything is viewed through the absolute worst of intentions. And the other piece with regard to civilian targeting that just came out, which again, I'm like, do you even read this? Like, are you aware that this is in the public domain at this point? Is the Where's Daddy software targeting program. Where it's like, okay, first of all, you have AI generating all these lists of men who are in the wrong WhatsApp group. And then just based on this AI generation, you just label them for death. So that's step number one. And step number two, okay, well, where are you going to actually find them? Well, the easiest thing to do is we've got their home addresses. So we're going to intentionally wait till they go back home with their wife and their kids and their relatives and whatever other civilians happen to be around. And if they're low-level rank-and-file assumed Hamas militants, we're going to use a dumb bomb on them because we don't want to waste precious guided munitions. and we're going to blow up the whole floor of that apartment building. We're going to level the entire apartment building. We're going to level the entire house. And we're going to make sure that it's when they're home with their families. Imagine if Hamas did that on October. Hamas committed all kinds of atrocities on October 7th. Don't get me wrong. But how do you think it would be viewed if they went to, you know, the home of an IDF soldier and intentionally, you know, targeted the home? They wouldn't see that as legitimate, nor should they. Imagine that it was an American service member who, you know, served in Iraq and had come back home to their family members and their wife and kids get intentionally blown up. Do you think we would see that as acceptable collateral damage and, oh, war is hell? No, of course not. That's intentional targeting of civilians. It's just undeniable at this point. So are they liars? Are they deluded? Are they living in a bubble? It genuinely is astonishing to me.
Yeah. My reaction to you last night when we watched this, the first thing I said to you was like, I don't know if there's a single good faith, honest defender of Israel anymore. Because, yeah, you in order to take the position they're taking, you have to definitionally assume pure intentions and motivations and a lack of nefariousness and a lack of purposeful targeting of civilians on the side of Israel. And the evidence is so overwhelming that they are targeting civilians on purpose that it doesn't hold up to even minimal scrutiny anymore. So that leads me to the inevitable conclusion that everybody who's still defending Israel, it's just dishonest. I don't know any way around that. And I'm the type of guy who historically I do the opposite. I assume take everybody at face value. What they say they believe is what they believe. But I'm really struggling with this one because I can't see it. So
the other thing is the talking points haven't budged a millimeter.
It's all
October
fortune
7th.
Cookie bullshit. You pull the string on the doll and they say the same things over and over.
Israel has a right to defend itself. Hamas is terrorists. They're Nazis. Israel's most moral army. They drop all the leaflets and make all the phone calls and they care so much about the civilian population. It's like none of the things that have unfolded post October, now more than 6 months past October 7th, none of that has budged you from that original position. How? Did you just shut your mind off after October 7th? Mm-hmm. And that was it.
Cenk makes a good point about that. He says, talking to the Israeli defenders, you guys remind me of my Turkish family members.
Right.
And he goes, I love them. There's nothing personal against them. But when they talk about Turkey, oh my God, Turks are the most angelic people on the planet. They've never done anything wrong to anybody. Yeah, they were bombing these people and they genocided the Armenians and they did this, but they were really defending themselves and they were trying their best and it was all defensive.
Yeah.
And he's exactly right about that. So I want to address one of the other early points that Batya made, because this in real time, you heard my reaction to this because I was like flabbergasted by it.
Yeah.
She thinks she has a gotcha point when she says, well, the ethnic cleansing charge and the genocide charge are contradictory. She thinks that's such like a own.
Right.
It's not remotely contradictory. First of all, Cenk makes a good point. I've heard him say this a number of times. He says there's a difference between a Holocaust and a genocide, right? And he says a Holocaust is when you, in theory, try to eradicate the entire group of people.
Right.
Whereas a genocide could be targeting in whole or in part, kind of. And they bring up where 6,000 Muslims were killed. Srebrenica? Am I saying that properly?
Srebrenica.
No, it's not Srebrenica. I think it's Srebrenica. Anyway, it's the is it the Bosnia-Kosovo thing? My history is lacking. But anyway, the point is that was considered legally a genocide where 6,000 Muslims were killed, right? And if that's considered a genocide, well, now we're already at 41,000 Palestinians killed. 36,000 of them are innocent civilians. 15,000 of them are children. 9,000 of them are women. So it absolutely can be both a genocide and an ethnic cleansing. You're killing Palestinians in very large numbers, and for the ones that you're not killing, you're trying to shove them through the Rafah border to set up a tent city in the Sinai Desert in Egypt.
Yeah.
So it can be both an ethnic cleansing and a genocide. The idea that, in her mind, what? It would be an ethnic cleansing if you're pushing them all through the border, or it's an ethnic or it's a genocide if you're trying to kill all of them. And they're not killing all of them, and they're not pushing all of them through the border, so therefore it's neither an ethnic cleansing nor a genocide. That's like, what are we in here, like high school debate class? What are you doing? This is such a horrible argument. They're doing both things.
Well, that's just not the definition of either of those things either. And the piece that I think is also really important in terms of classifying it as a genocide or a wholesale ethnic cleansing is to look beyond Gaza and to look beyond this present moment. I mean, Gaza has like accelerated everything this government has wanted to do for years and years. And, you know, Bibi and certainly his coalition partners are very upfront about many of the things that they want to do to Palestinians. One of his coalition partners talked about wiping an entire Palestinian village, quote, off the map during, you know, in the aftermath of a pogrom there that did kill some Palestinians and injured many, many more. But even in the context of post-October 7th, there's been an accelerated land grab in the West Bank. And you can't but Hamas that. Hamas is not in control of the West Bank. There's been accelerated land grab, largest official state land grab since the Oslo Accords. You've had a massive uptick in settler violence and pogroms against Palestinians in the West Bank, setting fires, killing people, injuring people, and, you know, stealing their land. So this is all part of a whole. The part that I also wanted to respond to, because this gets used a lot, it was Basia brought it up and it's used a number of times, and I've heard this talking point a million times, about, well, ask the Palestinians in Israel, the Arab Israeli Palestinian citizens, how they feel about living in Israel and their rights. And first of all, their rights are secondary to Jewish rights. They do have curtailed rights, but there's no doubt that they have a lot more rights than Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza do. And they use that to say, like, see, look, Israel's great. They don't have a problem with Palestinians. But you have to flip it. Then the natural question is, okay, well, great. Then why not just give rights to those same rights to all Palestinians that are living in this territory that you've basically annexed at this point? And it becomes really clear in response to that, that it's because they want a Jewish supremacist state. They always are going to have this demographic problem. They have to keep the Palestinian minority a small enough minority that can be completely controlled and not a threat to Jewish supremacist demography. And so that would be an unacceptable answer. And on the contrary, you know, the fact that Palestinians live in Israel and are, you know, peaceable and not a problem and not running around as terrorists also really undermines the viewpoint of people like Dennis Prager, who want to paint all Arabs basically as like barbarians and savages, and there's just something inherently wrong with them, so we could never live in peace with them. Well, you are living in peace with them. Guess why? They're peaceful because they have decent rights and they have a decent life. This isn't a hard thing to figure out ultimately.
So, by the way, just to, I was correct. It's, I said Srebrenica. It is that. It's just spelled weird. S-R-E-B-R-E-N-I-C-A.
Yeah, it's spelled like Srebrenica.
Right. And it was the killing of 8,000 Bosniak Muslims, and it's considered a genocide, and it happened in 1995. So if that's a genocide, this is absolutely, like, it's I don't even think it's close. But final point before I get to the next clip for you, Dave Smith keeps coming back to this point because they keep dodging it. And the point is, Netanyahu funded Hamas so that Palestinians can't get their freedom. Part of the divide and conquer strategy, separate the Palestinian Authority from Hamas, separate the West Bank from Gaza, etc. So for him to do that, and then now it's like, all, well, Hamas is the worst thing ever, and we got to take them all out, and we got to kill every last one of them. It's like, you can't say shit now.
Right.
Like, you helped build this monster.
Yeah.
And they can't honestly engage with that point. And the closest they come is when they're like, well, he didn't really know the monster he was funding. And Cenk is like, really? You didn't know Hamas? These Islamic extremists?
Prager also makes this claim of like, well, he wanted to keep it from being something even worse. Like, you literally just made that up. No one even argues that.
And also,
no,
you say they're Nazis. That. What's worse than Nazis?
Right.
You say they're Nazis.
But I literally have never heard anyone say that. Like, he just made that up in real time.
Fact.
Because he was in a tight spot in the debate.
Right. So, all right, let's go to this last clip.
The idea that some lobby is the reason that an idea has power in the United States is completely backwards. The lobby gets its power because it is representing where, like, the majority of Americans are at. A lobby on its own, you think the NRA...
You don't think it's shaping it a little
bit? You think
that
the NRA is the reason that people have guns in America? Really, you don't think that?
No, the NRA are a bunch of sellouts.
No, but the idea is a very good parallel.
Americans have overwhelmingly supported Israel. If there was no AIPAC, they still would have supported Israel.
So that, then why do we need an AIPAC?
Why do we need an NRA?
Well, yeah, exactly.
We don't.
All right, fine. So you... Well,
I don't think
right.
we need AIPAC either. Israel would be just fine without it because the American people have its back.
Right, go ahead.
Whether we need it or not is not the question. The question is, why do they exist, given the fact, which is fair, why do they exist? Because people lobby politicians on behalf of what many Americans support. Americans to this day and every poll still support Israel, as it happens. So the arguments that have been offered here, it really is a different planet. Just for the record, this may come as a shock to the two of you at least, many listening. And I would put my hand on a Bible, I would take a lie detector test, because obviously there's no way I could prove this. When I watched, I remember sitting at the edge of my bed watching this, and I never watched TV. I watched Arafat and Rabin shake hands, and I had tears in my eyes. That is how badly I wanted peace. I supported a two-state solution nearly all of my life, certainly since the Six-Day War when I was a college kid. I have always supported it. I no longer support it, just like nearly every peace activist in Israel no longer supports it. And we don't support it thanks to Hamas and thanks to the PLO.
I mean, that says it all right there, right? He's like, I don't support peace.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, then you can go ahead and shut the fuck up. Because the whole assumption in these discussions is always like, well, we want peace and the terrible, evil Palestinians don't want peace. But no, I don't even want a two-state solution. Definitely not a one-state solution where everybody gets rights, and definitely not a two-state solution. So it's like, what are we doing here? It's like when Netanyahu and hardline Israelis say, from the river to the sea, they want a greater Israel, right? And people just yawn at that. But then if some pro-Palestine protester says, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, Congress passes a fucking bill calling it officially anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's like, what are we doing here?
Rashida Tlaib for, you know, retweeting that call.
It's the power imbalance drives me crazy. We don't have a partner for peace on the other side. But by the way, I never want a two-state solution. I never want a one-state solution. And if you say free Palestine, you're an anti-Semite.
I mean,
what are we doing here?
He literally, at a different point in the debate, was like, if you're being honest, you know what would happen if the Palestinians laid down their arms. There'd be peace. And it was like... How do you say that? And then minutes later, admit you don't even want peace.
Correct.
And by the way, this always ignores that there's been so much genuine, nonviolent resistance. Mm. The Great March of Return.
That's right.
We had Palestinians who were massing at the border. And they were sniped and massacred by the IDF.
That's right.
Another Israeli atrocity. What do you know?
We forgot that one, too, because there's so fucking many of them.
So I always hate this notion that the only resistance from Palestine, they're just blowing up school buses and that's all they do. It's like, no. Anything that they try to do, first of all, they get murdered, like in that nonviolent resistance. Those of us who are supporters of the Palestinian cause around the world, we're smeared as anti-Semitic if we support a sanction movement.
BDS, that's right.
Right. We're smeared as illiberal by New York Magazine if we support protesting people in power who are facilitating a genocide. We're authoritarian, illiberal, etc. Tom Cotton says we should be thrown off a bridge and have our skin ripped off. So you leave people with no path to protest and try to change their situation. What the fuck do you think is going to happen? What do you think that they're going to, some number of them are going to resort to? But the part that I loved,
tee off on this.
When Bhatti is like, AIPAC has power because the American people just genuinely love Israel. And we don't even need AIPAC because there's so much just popular majority sentiment.
Send billions more to Israel now. We demand it.
Sending weapons to Israel. And I mean, it's just like, I think I don't want to be too harsh with Bhatti specifically, but I think if she was looking at any other part of our political system, I have a feeling she would recognize the corrupting influence of money in politics.
Right.
I don't think that most people would go, yeah, you know why the banking industry always gets deregulated
and bailed out
their way and bail? It's because the American people just love, you know, making Wall Street criminals into billionaires and them never being held accountable. That's why their lobby has power, is because there's so much genuine popular sentiment in favor. It's like, I know you don't think that. That's such a fantasy world to imagine that's how politics works.
This is why we gave Saudi Arabia billions of dollars, and this is why we armed them when they were doing a genocide in Yemen, because the American people were crying out for this. They were in the streets going, arm Saudi Arabia!
Yes.
Arm Saudi Arabia!
Right.
Arm Saudi Arabia!
Right. And the reason why this gigantic Ukraine and Israel aid package is about to pass is because the American people are so excited about, instead of having health care or solving homelessness or having affordable child care or child tax credit or whatever, we really want to send those tax dollars, that we just wrote a check to the IRA. We really want to use that to bomb babies and put a gun in the hand of a mentally disabled Ukrainian who doesn't want to fight, but who's being shipped off to the front lines anyway. That's what we want to use our tax dollars for. There's huge popular sentiment in favor of that.
Yeah, we should poll this question. Should we help out the 650,000 homeless Americans? Probably about 100,000 of them are veterans, by the way. Should we help them, or should we take that money and send it to Israel and Ukraine for the 98th time within the past three fucking years with all the aid package after aid package after weapon shipment after weapon shipment? Obviously, the American people would cry out, please send more weapons to Israel and Ukraine.
Well, and we know. I mean, listen, some of these people in Congress, Mike Johnson, he is a genuine religious zealot. I don't actually think the money is the thing for him. He is like ideologically, even Joe Biden, I think is like a genuine ideological
in a different way.
Zionist in a different way. Mike Johnson, it's this religious
end times.
Fervor.
They want to usher in the
terrifying
Gog and Magog war.
But there are plenty of, think about John Fetterman. And this is Ryan Grimm's reporting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fetterman was up against Conor Lamb in his Democratic primary. He didn't really think that much about Israel and was like, hey, Democratic majority for Israel, what should my position be? Because I don't want you to back my opponent. I want you to be on my side. And they're like, here's your position. And he's like, cool, got it. This happens all the time. It happens all the number. Ryan has a bunch of other examples in his book, too, by the way, of members of candidates and members of Congress who were terrified of that money coming in against them. And so they change what they're saying in real time. Maxwell Frost, another example, change what they think, what they're saying in real time to try to thwart the AIPAC money. AIPAC is starting $100 million against anyone who dissents even an inch or who they even think might dissent in the future.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You don't think that has an impact on our politics? I pulled up some polling right now. Question. Experts have said Israel would not be able to continue these attacks on Gaza without the continued shipments of weapons from the U.S. Do you think the U.S. should stop weapon shipments to Israel until Israel discontinues its attack on the people of Gaza? 52% majority say we should stop shipping the weapons. Only 27% say no, and another 21% are unsure. So it's for Dennis Prager's, you know, oh no, every poll shows Americans love Israel and they support Israel, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, really? Not this one.
I mean, bringing up the will of the American people, the very first response has to be a majority of Americans want a ceasefire. A majority of Democrats, a majority of independents, a majority
days.
Of Republicans.
That's right.
They all want a ceasefire. So if you really want to talk about the will of the American people, I'm more than willing to do that because the facts are all on our side.
That's right.
Over 50% of Biden voters say this is a genocide.
That's right.
This is not, these aren't like radicals. These aren't extremists. These
That's
are people
right.
who have eyes and ears and just know what's going on because they can scroll through a fucking social media feed and see a dead kid underneath the rubble.
That's right. Even in the very early days after October 7th, when it became clear the level of devastation and annihilation that Israel is engaged in Gaza, I mean, very quickly, you had a supermajority in support of a ceasefire, even at a time when Karine Jean-Pierre was at the podium saying that position was, quote unquote, repugnant.
Right.
Repugnant. So you're going to tell me that these legislators just are, you know, genuinely representing the will of the people and money has nothing to do with mm-hmm. it. And the threat of, you know, millions of dollars spent against them in their next primary has nothing to do with it. Come on.
Mm.
Come on. I mean, do you really believe that?
That's
like,
what I'm
do
saying.
Do you really believe
it
that?
It goes back to the point I made before, which is that I am the first person to always assume good intent and good faith in a discussion. But I'm really struggling with this particular issue. I'm really struggling because I can't help. It's such an overwhelming sense that these people are just being dishonest, man. They're being dishonest. So anyway, great job to Dave Smith. Great job to Cenk Uygur. Everybody go check out the full debate. They have it on the Breaking Points channel. So go check it out for sure. It got great views, by the way.
Yeah.
More people should go watch it. Definitely go watch the whole thing. We couldn't do the whole thing justice here, but it was really good. And let's try to get Dave Smith on the show because it'll be an interesting conversation if we do that.
Yeah, definitely the worst person on that panel was Dennis Prager.
Oh, by a mile and a half.
Not even close.
By a mile and a half.
Not even close. I mean, Bato at least sometimes try to acknowledge, like, you know, things that were tough or challenging for her point of view.
Well,
but Prager was just...
I was going to give her all the smoke, but then at the end of the debate, she said something that was really, like, sweet. And so I couldn't do it. Because she was like, all right, let's go through the areas where we agreed in the debate. And then she lists them. And I was like, I can't go off on her. It's not nice. I gotta, you know,
that's tough.
It's
be nastier. So
Prager gets all the smoke. Yeah. Prager gets all the smoke.
He was genuinely though the worst actor.
Yeah,
on. And he was such an asshole to people. And then bringing up that libel thing, that was like the most obnoxious
cheap
part
tricks,
of the whole
man. Debate. Cheap tricks.
Yeah.
Is Dave Smith Jewish? He might be Jewish.
I have no idea.
I'm gonna look this up because I mean it would just be chef's kiss perfect if you know, you're effectively accusing this Jewish guy who's against what Israel is doing of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, well, I mean,
they do it all the time. They do it with Jewish Voice for Peace. They do it with Not
Katie
in Our
Halper,
Name.
All the time. Self-loathing. Norman Finkelstein is accused of being a Holocaust denier. You know, they're certainly not afraid.
Yeah, Dave Smith is Jewish.
Okay.
God, Dennis Prager is such a fucking piece of garbage. Okay. All right. Let's bring in Motaz.
So to lighten, to show the light side of things, not like the light in terms of happy or funny, but the positive activist side of what is being done to try to stop this genocide. We're very lucky to be joined by Palestinian American activist Motaz Salem. You probably have seen some of the clips of him confronting members of Congress, really just putting in their face his own humanity as a Palestinian American who has lost more than 100 family members in Gaza. Let's get to it. Very lucky to be joined in studio today by a really courageous activist, Palestinian-American activist, Motaz Salem, who's been in the halls of Congress confronting members basically every day. It seems like you're in there.
Every day.
Every single day.
Taz, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
Likewise. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Just introduce yourself a little bit to the audience. Tell them how you came to this advocacy.
Of course. My name is Motaz. I'm Palestinian American. I have my father's from Gaza. I have a lot of family in Gaza. I initially moved to DC for grad school. I'm doing right now a doctorate in clinical psychology. And so I got into doing this. I was really pushed by what happened after October 7th, the Israeli response, and sort of the genocide, all the war crimes that they've committed against Gaza, in the West Bank, in the south of Lebanon too, where my mother is from. And I've always been, you know, very, I've tried to advocate my whole life.
Yeah.
But there was actually a time not too long ago where I was very secretive sort of about my identity because, and there are many Palestinians who can attest to this. Our parents tell us, especially since I was moving to North America, I lived in Canada before I moved here. And so I've been in North America almost 9 years now, over 9 years. And we're told to keep our identity quiet because of fears of being doxxed, fears of being harassed for just literally just being Palestinian, which, I mean, it may seem extreme to people who are not super familiar with the advocacy for Palestine, but it's actually a very justified fear that, you know, my parents had as well as most parents do, most people do. And so, like two, three months after October 7th, I mean, I was going to protests every week, showing up, trying to like educate my friends about what's going on. But it just progressively got worse and worse. And Israel wouldn't stop its crimes and its genocide and just like massacre after massacre. I felt like I had to do more. And I sort of stopped really caring about any sort of potential retaliation or repercussion of being so outspoken about Palestine. There have been repercussions for sure. But it, you know, you reach a point like, I don't want Palestine to just be, and like what's happening now, to just be a chapter in a history book, you know? And then eventually we look back and say, oh, you know, how sad it was what happened to them, and move on. A little bit sort of like how I feel like the education system here treats the Native Americans. And it's like, oh, look at all these sad things, Trail of Tears. And oh, well, we are here now. And I don't want to let that happen.
And you've been personally affected.
Correct. Yes. I've lost. So it's a big number. And I say that because I will admit that I don't know every person that in my family who's been killed by Israel, it's 161 individuals. None past like first cousin or first aunt, first uncle. Like these are all Palestinians have big families in general. My dad was one of 10 siblings. But there are a lot of them that I knew well, that I was close to. And actually just the most recent one was last Monday, not this week, but the week before. And was someone who I was in, you know, somewhat regular contact with, and they were killed as well in an airstrike. So, you know, it's unconscionable. It's hard to even process. I don't think we're meant to process. This is like me speaking as a psychologist in training. Right. Like, there's nothing, there's no literature on how to process such like mass grief and genocide, and especially in this sort of almost comically evil way that Israel has carried out its actions.
So you were in contact with a number of your family members who were there, and some who even passed away?
Correct.
Wow. Yes. Have you ever been to Palestine, whether it be Gaza, West Bank?
I have when I was much younger. I think I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. I had the opportunity. I mean, I have an American citizenship, so I've had the opportunity to go back, but it's always felt wrong to, because my dad can't go back. He was one time able to when, I think it was when Morsi in Egypt had his very short reign, and he opened up the Rafah crossing.
Oh, interesting.
And I was in like high school then, I believe. So,
and by the way, he was cooed too, by the way.
He was cooed, yes. He was.
Yeah, that's right.
He was democratically elected too.
That's right.
That's not an endorsement of him or his belief. Mm-hmm. He was democratically elected, and the Egyptian military said, no, we're not dealing with
that's
this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But that was the only time my dad's been able to go in my lifetime outside when I was much younger. And so I haven't been since, because I don't want to go on my own. And like, you know, for me, it's I have an attachment to the land, but also especially through my father, who had to like sneak himself out of Gaza in order to allow me to be here in front of you guys. So,
wow. How did he manage to do that?
I honestly don't know the specific details of the story, but I know that he was a smart kid in the equivalent of high school in Gaza, and he went to Egypt to get a medical degree, actually. So I don't know the details. I wish I did, but he actually doesn't tell me. It's hard to get many details out of him, because I think, one, he fears how much advocacy I'm doing. He has like, he worries about me as a parent, and like, even like when I found out, like, for example, I found out about some more deaths in our family in Gaza, I had to press him a lot for it. And I realized that he might have not been telling me, because he like didn't want me to just like.
He's trying to protect you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Has it been difficult? I mean, it must be difficult to even keep track of who's safe, who's not safe.
Yes. Yes. We try to be in regular contact, as regular as possible, with our family in Gaza, as does he. But it's, you know, the internet cuts off every now and then, and yeah.
So is all your family in Gaza, or are there some in the West Bank too?
On my father's side, they're primarily in Gaza. We have one aunt who lives in the West Bank, and actually we have and one of my uncles lives in the West Bank too, but he was visiting our family in Gaza before October 7th. He's been stuck there since.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, should we take a look at a little bit of what you've been up to with our great elected representatives, spending our tax dollars well to, you know, ship more bombs to drop on top of babies. So we'll start with this first one. In the wake of 7 World Central Kitchen aid workers being assassinated by Israel, you confronted Senator Josh Hawley in the hallways about that action, whether that changes his view. Let's take a look at that.
Okay. In terms of the Israel aid, do you have any comment on the World Central Kitchen aid workers that were struck the seven members of the World Central Kitchen?
Oh, well, listen.
Do you think anything like we should maybe withhold aid to Israel?
Oh, no.
Figure that out?
No, I'm totally in favor of giving aid to Israel, and I wish that we had done it right after October 7th. I
mean, yeah. Even with them striking humanitarian workers?
Well, listen.
An American citizen as well?
It's tragic, but I'm 100% in favor of Israel being able to defend itself. So I wish we'd give them aid.
So it's tragic. But
Israel has a right to defend itself from World Central Kitchen workers.
That's right.
Like,
and
what are we doing here?
Thousands of children and women and hospitals. And I mean, that's the thing that is kind of incredible. Like, he can't even really defend it.
No,
it just goes right back to the talking point. So tell us a little bit specifically about the context of that interaction.
So, I mean, I'm in Congress every day. And usually when we're in Congress, we either do like office visits where we try to speak with staffers, or we like will wait outside of hearings or try to go into hearings to disrupt them.
We've heard the staffers are more receptive. Is that true?
Some are. I mean, as an overall, for sure, they're more receptive than the actual like representatives.
Mm-hmm.
Most definitely. There are some that sort of like sip the Kool-Aid of the congressman.
Mm.
Those really, they really piss me off.
Medea told us one of the staffers, they actually cried.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you there for that interaction?
So, that was, I think we have a video of it, of I was actually showing them a list of the names, of some of the names of my family members that have died as a result of Israel's aggression. And I was asking them, I'm like, I can't even fathom this list. How about you? Like, can you look at this? And like, how are you supposed to process this? And I think it sort of really got to him, because it's a very valid question.
Mm.
Like, what, like, it's a list of over 100 names. It's like, how can you even defend anyone who's responsible for this?
Has your psychology training helped you at all to understand some of the rationalizing that's going on, or the way that, you know, so much of Israeli society seems to have not only accepted, embraced, pushed for more brutality in the Gaza Strip? Has that helped serve as a sort of roadmap for you?
I wouldn't say a roadmap, because I honestly think it's maybe where like the framework of psychology that exists now, I don't think it's well equipped to understand just how much indoctrination and like just how hateful some of the views that are pretty like regular in Israeli society are, or that come from like Josh Hawley, for example.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance for sure. Just like, and I notice in a lot of interactions, like, people like the staffers or the representatives will like squirm and just like be so uncomfortable just from our presence.
Like visibly uncomfortable.
Visibly uncomfortable. And just from like me having a keffiyeh on, or, you know, we have some people who regularly come with us who have the hijab on, and you can tell they just like, there's sort of this feeling that they understand what they're doing is horrible. But there is just so many layers of like psychological defenses against that. Just like, you know, whether it's AIPAC money, whether they're like a Christian Zionist who just like believes this is necessary for the end times.
I mean, those have to be the people who have the genuine like religious fundamentalist like fervor. It's almost got to be the easiest for them, because for them, they're like, well, it's God's will. This it's is just God's what's got to happen. Yeah. What's not on me.
Yep.
So for them, I can see how, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
But for them, I feel like you wouldn't see that squirming. They're just like, it is what it is.
They squirm less. They, you know, they squirm less, and they're the ones that are, they almost get a kick out of like us confronting them, because they, you know, something we've noticed recently is some of them will have their own like intern, like whatever intern they got in their office, will follow them around with the camera.
Oh.
So that like they film the interaction.
Oh, they think this is going well for them.
Yes. The guy who introduced the the bill condemning From the River to the Sea passed this week. His name is Congressman Despacito. My theory is that he did that to like get back at us, maybe, because we confront him a lot, and he started having his own guy taking videos, and he like edits it in a way to make us sound like we're really dumb or like just like these angry crazy people. And it's funny, when he put it on Twitter, like, he got quote tweeted like a lot of times, and like all the replies were dragging him, and I don't think he realizes he's giving us more like amplification of our actions. And but I feel like those people, to your point, the sort of evangelical Christian Zionists, they don't even have that sort of like AIPAC money or not. They just like view this as God's will and like God's destiny, you know? Like, we are supposed to have this.
What's worse, the true believers or the cynics? Because you see so many of our politicians take so much money from AIPAC or DMFI and the entire Israel lobby. Yeah. And for some of them, you have to imagine it is literally just a financial transaction, right? Yeah. I don't care about the issue either way, but if you're going to give me $600,000 for my campaign, then sure, I'll say whatever the hell you want, right? Yeah. Yeah. What's worse? Is it that like totally heartless, cold, transactional stuff? Or is it the ones who are like the evangelical Christian fundamentalist Zionists who are all in on Gog and Magog returning to Israel and the end times happening and Jesus coming back and killing almost all the Jews and all that stuff?
If I were to pick, I mean, they're both pretty awful.
Yeah.
If I were to pick, I would say for me, the bought out
are worse
because I think of it from a point of view of how malleable is this person in terms of the way they think. And, you know, this evangelical who tells me that, you know, this is God's will and there will always be like Congressman Scott McCormick of Georgia. He once told us, argued with me for 15 minutes about the origin of the conflict and, you know, the history, and trying to tell me this like Zionist version of the history that I've heard a million times before.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
And but he ended the conversation with, well, anyway, we're not going to have peace in that region till the end times, because that's just what God willed. This guy is also like an MD, which always talks about that. Which
unbelievable.
Is like, it's like modern medicine, Christian Zionism, who knows?
Yeah, it makes no sense.
What do you make of, because this is, I've thought about this a lot, because I used to work at MSNBC. I knew Karine Jean-Pierre, right? Mm-hmm. And I know she came up through MoveOn. She was an anti-war activist. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like I bring this up all the time because I just am a little bit obsessed with this idea of, when does it happen? Like, when do you have that decision that's like, I can either have principles or I can have power or prestige or visibility, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And the sort of like the way you have to convince yourself that, well, you know, I really am still that liberal humanitarian anti-war activist. Like, I'm the same person. And you know, is it, if it wasn't me, it'd be someone else, or these activists, they just don't understand the realities. Like, how do you make sense of a person like that who is now standing at a podium every day and at times outright, you know, mocking Palestinians, mocking activists? She's the one who said the position of a ceasefire was, quote unquote, repugnant.
Oh, my God.
I can't make sense. I really can't make sense of that.
Yeah. I honestly, like, I try to think about it and try not to think about it too much, but the best way I can make sense of it is, you know, on a simple level, is there's just this allure to having the prestige. She's, you know, like the spokesperson for, I don't know what her official title is, but I think like
White House press secretary.
White House press secretary. Yeah. And I'm thinking right now of like Matt Miller,
State Department.
He's the worst.
And just like, I sometimes feel bad for him, not for like, just his. I feel bad for how many lies he's had to peddle, just like as an official spokesperson, and just how I think it's just about, there's something about the title, the allure of like, I am the spokesperson of the State Department and I need to like hold my ground. Like, this is my duty and whatever my superiors tell me, I just have to. And to break through to someone who's part of that apparatus, that system, I think is very difficult because to them, this is what is right. I think like Matt Miller is like convinced of some of what he's saying. As absurd as it is,
yeah.
I think he's fully convinced himself, like, this is the truth.
And I think they also do those mental gymnastics of, like, well, this is just the job, and if it wasn't me, it'd be someone else. And if I'm in the inside, I can affect change from here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you can almost visibly see which ones have the most difficult time rationalizing it.
Matt's always sweaty. He's always sweating up there.
Yeah, he's always sweating up there. Jake Sullivan just looks like a ghost of a person. Like, the eyes are so dead when you look at him at this point.
Kirby's a scumbag.
Kirby, I feel like he sleeps fine at night.
Yeah.
He's one of these true believers. He thinks it's righteous. He hates the Palestinians. He doesn't see them as human beings. Yep. That's the vibe I get
from
him.
Total bullshitter, too.
Blinken looks like he's aged like a decade.
Yeah.
And he said that thing that one time about the kids that have been killed, they're going to like stay with him for the rest of his life. But then you're still out there doing the thing.
Yep.
So Samantha Power is another one. It's like,
oh yeah. Oh yeah.
How do you reconcile these things?
Samantha Power, I'm glad you mentioned her. We actually confronted her. It was last week. Because she was giving hearings left and right to whatever committee, so many committees. And that's part of why, like, she confirmed that a famine is underway. And I confronted her and asked her, can you please speak on why there is a famine? Why people are starving? She was silent the whole time. Then I told her, like, I'm from Gaza. Look at me. I'm from Gaza. And she looks at me and says, like, I'm so sorry. And, like, she looked sincerely distraught. I think I've gotten pretty good at, like, gauging people's, like, reactions and emotions in their face.
Yeah.
And she looked sincerely distraught when I told her that. And she was, like, met with this reality of, like, oh, this is, like, one of the people who, I mean, there is a world where I'm a person on the ground who's killed in an airstrike. But then she goes and continues to, you know, as the head of the USAID, she can't, she should, but she feels like she can't actually speak on the full truth of what's going
That's
on.
That's astonishing. And she even had a moment of humanity, I mean, because she seems so cold.
Just a glimpse. And that is really disheartening to me. It's like you had this glimpse and then you go and just like lie, you know, in front of these committees, in front of all these representatives. And it's tragic, honestly. It's tragic that the power that having that prestige and that position has on, like, people just losing their humanity and having, like, no principles, really.
What do you make of, you probably run into this all the time, but I've definitely noticed this quite a bit, the passive language that's used when it comes to atrocities against Palestinians versus the very emotive, purposeful language used when it's about Israeli civilians. So The Intercept did an analysis of this when it comes to the media, and it was astonishing. You talk about words like slaughter, massacre, atrocity, horrific, terrorism. All that is used when talking about Israeli civilians. When talking about Palestinian civilians, it's always a blast injured X number of people.
Right.
Like, it's so surgical.
They're
passive.
Minors. They're not children. Mm-hmm. They're not mothers.
That's
they're
right.
females.
Right.
You know, a young lady was a descriptor of a 3-year-old little girl.
Yeah.
So are you running into this with your real world interactions too? Because I just noticed it a little bit from Holly. Holly said, oh, what happened was tragic.
Yes.
No, it's not tragic. It was an absolute war crime where they murdered these workers on purpose.
Correct. I have noticed it a lot. I think I'll also mention that their new favorite term is military-aged men, which is despicable. Honestly.
Let's decode that for people. Military-aged men means there's zero evidence that these people are combatants in any way, shape, or form. But since they're military-aged men, if we kill them, they had it coming.
Yes.
That's what that
essentially
means.
Essentially, consent for massacring young men.
Literally any man.
That's
literally
right.
any
or
man.
Or even, I mean, teenagers or yeah. old men or whatever.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
talk about a literal war on men. And you see this, you know, the news coverage, like, on one hand, I guess I understand, because if it's a woman or a child, like, they're definitionally a civilian, yes. right?
There's no excuse, like,
but
at
then,
all.
Right. But then you just are assuming
all
that
the men
every single man who's mm-hmm. killed must be guilty.
That's yep. right.
And yep. you see this in the way that Israel has behaved. I mean, yes. you know, we just have this new report come from UNRWA about the horrific torture and abuse and rape
yeah.
that has been perpetrated against Palestinian, you know, they'll call them detainees. You might also call them hostages.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Thousands of whom mm-hmm. have been, you know, taken by Israel. And it's enough that they're a quote unquote military age man to yeah. assume their guilt.
Yes.
And I think this does, I mean, it's horrifying just in this context, but it's also horrifying because you know these things won't stay in this conflict.
Yeah.
It opens yep. up Pandora's box yep. for, you know, the rest of the world and every future conflict to come.
Any sort of oppressed peoples that's not considered by like the US mainstream media as like allies or as, I mean, it's really, it's rooted, I think, in race, because when we see like partially in race, I don't think it's the whole picture, but I think that the comparison I make and the reason I make this comparison is because you can see it side to side, especially with the New York Times or New York war crimes, as I like to call them. Whenever there's a strike in like Mariupol or, you know, in Ukraine mm-hmm. and it's always like egregious Russian airstrike,
right.
Massacres right. innocent Ukrainian babies. It's like, oh, you guys are capable of
right.
actually parsing it out and presenting that truth. But when it's in Gaza, it's like bomb somehow
right. right. yeah.
detonates and Palestinians report
right.
20
right. Yeah.
people dead or something.
And that's exactly right.
There's always like little seeds of doubt they try to implant in the language.
That's exactly
and
right.
The way the a lot of staffers and the representatives especially talk is even and I mean this is I see it even when people are being sympathetic, there's like a reluctance. There's sort of this like block from calling it a genocide, for example.
Right.
Like it's still so controversial to call it a genocide in the halls of Congress.
Which is wild.
Yes.
How much more yes. evidence do you need? I mean, we saw this the other day. There was that big report about the New York Times that came out where there was a memo that came down from the top where they said,
mm-hmm.
don't say genocide, ethnic cleansing, occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
Don't say Palestine.
Refugee
that was
camp.
The craziest one. They literally said, don't say Palestine.
So this is a war on the truth. Let's just call it what it is.
I mean,
it's a war on the truth.
It's erasure. They are literally like, that's the name of the freaking country.
Right.
Palestine.
And you're a news organization, quote unquote.
Yes. Yes.
Paper of record.
Yes.
And yeah, in occupied territory, that to me was wild. So it was all the parts about like genocide, ethnic cleansing. It should be shocking, but I wasn't shocked by those.
Yeah.
But refugee camp, Palestine.
Yeah.
And there's actually a new study out. Fair Media just released this. Since October 7th, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal have overwhelmingly applied the term brutal only to violence that's committed by Palestinians. So in the case, it's like, you know, 90% of the instances of
where they say
where it's brutal. It's, you know,
October 7th and
when
not.
It's Palestinians
yep.
committing crimes and when yep. it's Israelis, it's sanitized. Yep. Like you said, they love to sow the doubt.
Yep. You would think the death toll is reversed the way they talk.
That's yeah. absolutely right. Right.
You would think exactly. that it's 41,000 Israelis who've been killed.
Yeah.
And there right? was that poll that came out that said that many Americans couldn't say which side had suffered more
oh my yeah. God.
Casualties.
And that makes sense because that's what... Because
if you look at this news coverage...
Yeah. Unless you like consume specific sources that aren't like mainstream media here in the US, like, I mean, I'll give a shout out to The Intercept because they're reporting and especially like
Scahill and Grimm have been on top.
Scahill,
yeah.
Grimm, and Prem Thakur
mm-hmm.
have been like a godsend, honestly, especially in this like Western US context, because it's really the only like remotely large outlet that you see this sort of the full truth being displayed, which is not what like CNN and the New York Times and what have you.
What's interesting is when they have moments, because like it'll be like 2 weeks of horrific, terrible coverage. Then every now and like one segment you'll see and it'll be something that you're like, I can't believe this got through. Because remember, there was the IDF. Remember the story about like the IDF censor was getting the last word?
Yeah.
Yes.
Like they had to run it by them at CNN.
That was also Intercept reporting.
Remember that? That's insane. What are we talking? Imagine running a story about Iran by the Revolutionary Guard.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody be like, what, the Grand Ayatollah's got veto power over what you're going to write? That's what what's happening with Israel. That's crazy.
Right. And what they do is if it's a quote from the Israeli government, the IDF, they just print it. Done. No checking, no whatever, no hand-wringing. It's just in, it's fact, it's done.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it's a quote from a Palestinian, well, we're not sure. We need to caveat it. We need to check. I'm sorry, this doesn't make it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's take a look at probably your most infamous exchange with, what is it, Congressman Chuck Fleischman?
Chuck Fleischman.
Now, before I play
Tennessee District 2. So.
Is this a, you put him in the, like, true believer? What?
Christian Zionist.
Christian Zionist.
He puts him in the paranoid schizophrenic camp.
Yeah.
Paranoid schizophrenic.
We can get into the psychology.
Evangelical Zionist.
Okay. All right. So you're talking to him in the hallway. Let's just take a look at this, how this unfolds.
You can tell the Palestinians, I am a Palestinian myself.
Why do you support the genocide and all of the war crimes and collective punishment? Are you concerned about all the children?
Let me make it clear. Israel is our ally, will always be our ally.
Even if they commit war crimes?
They are not guilty of genocide, and I will support Israel forever.
Israel will stay your ally, even though they commit genocide. Even
that's your term.
Can you explain?
Even when
they kill 30,000 kids, that is a statistic.
What they did to the Israeli people on October. Let me tell you a statistic. Israel will exist. The Jewish state will exist.
That's not a statistic.
That's not what we're, and that is for God to do with what we're saying.
And I will always support Israel. I will always support Israel. And you can tell the Palestinians, I will never support them.
I am a Palestinian myself.
Then I will tell you, I will never support you. I will tell you to your face.
And you want my cousins to die.
Goodbye to Palestine. We will support Israel forever.
So you are comfortable.
No, just FYI, this guy just said goodbye to Palestine.
Always support Israel.
So you just said goodbye to Palestine. So you are saying you are comfortable with the murder of thousands of children.
The Jewish people will never suffer again under Palestinian terrorism, under Hamas. Under Hezbollah.
What about 30,000 innocent civilians?
God bless Israel forever.
Thank you for
saying that. Wipe Palestine off the earth. Yeah?
Woo. All right. So we were talking before the cameras were on that it doesn't take much for these people to just go like, I'm a Nazi.
Yeah.
That's what I feel like I just watched there. We will support Israel forever. It literally doesn't matter at all what they do.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter at all. There were people considering nuking Gaza after October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
So according to this guy, if they nuked Gaza,
he'd still be Israel forever. You can tell the Palestinians, I will never support them. I will never support you. Mm-hmm. Goodbye to Palestine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the video sort of speaks for itself, honestly, about how normalized it's become, this sort of anti-Palestinian rhetoric. It's a form of racism that's just like no one bats an eye at anymore, because Chuck Fleischman's not alone. I mean, just yesterday we confronted Brian Mast, for example.
Oh, he's the worst.
By the way, wore an IDF uniform to Congress. That's a foreign military's uniform.
Yeah, no big deal.
The U.S. Congress.
No big deal. Let's have somebody go wear an Iranian uniform to see how that goes.
Can you imagine?
I'm gonna go waving a Hezbollah flag into Congress. Let me see how they treat me.
This is making me want to do that. Yeah, for sure.
Enjoy Guantanamo.
Yeah, right. That's what will happen. They'll ship me there for sure.
Yesterday, Brian Mast said, he kept referring to Gaza as our non-ally. He really meant enemy.
Mm.
But he said, Gaza as a whole is our non-ally. And I told him, like, as a whole, like, everyone. And he said, I think I was pretty clear about that. Like, he clarified it.
He said that a number of times.
Yes.
There are no innocent civilians in Gaza.
Yes. And we actually went to the, there was Tim Walberg, his name is. He's a Michigan congressman. He's the one who cited, in case we weren't for sure getting what he was saying. He cited, you know, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, we should do that.
That's right. I covered that. Yep. I covered that.
Wow.
We tried going to his office. I actually have a funny video on my Instagram of like, we tried to visit his office, which is locked all the time now. Mm. It's the only office that locks us out.
Wow. Mm.
And I literally spoke through the mail slot. Mm. I was like, does the congressman still want a new Gaza? Like, I'm a Palestinian American. Maybe I can change his mind. Tell him why that's a bad idea. And then like they called the cops on us and the cops were like, is everything okay? I was like, I literally just spoke through the mail slot. That's it. We didn't try to force ourselves in or anything. But anyways, the bigger point is I don't have the words for how concerning it is, how normal it's become to just hate Palestinians and to say outrageous things about Palestinians, like goodbye to Palestine. Like Gaza as a whole is our enemy, implying like every single individual in there. And you're right, Brian Mast before has said like that even the babies are not innocent,
right?
Who have been killed because they could potentially grow up to be a terrorist. It's awful.
I've never seen anything like this because I remember, you know, my big enlightenment moment was growing up witnessing the Iraq War and all that stuff. Yeah. And just remembering the horror of that and Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay and hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians killed and millions displaced and all of that stuff. It was horrible. But I also remember at the time, even George W. Bush gave a speech saying, like, our issue is not with all Muslims. Our issue is with the terrorists, with Al-Qaeda and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And there was at least an attempt to put a veneer of seriousness or respectability over it. But in this instance, it's all hanging out. Mm-hmm. Like, the hatred, the racism, the bigotry, these are non-humans. And our allies are good by definition, no matter what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've literally never seen anything like it before. I mean, the fact that over 20 hospitals in Gaza have been attacked, they have systematically destroyed all of the schools in Gaza. Mm-hmm. That alone, never mind the 9,000 other things that we could talk about, like that alone is mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
And we're still, hey, here's your money, here's your weapons.
They've destroyed mosques and churches that are thousands of years old. And that's really when early on when people were still debating whether it's a genocide. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest indicators that it is because it's not like for me, and based on what I understand a genocide is, it's not just like the pure number, which I think is like a psychopathic argument that people have made to me.
Right.
Like,
They didn't kill all of them.
Or oh my God, like there's this like Jew belong account or something that once they put out a post and then they deleted it of like, they could wipe them out if they wanted to. Like something along those
lines.
We've
heard that
and
one
it's
before.
Like, oh my freaking God, dude. Like what is going on? How can you say this about anyone? But for me, what really, like, I was like, oh my God, they are going all in on the genocide is they destroyed almost every university in Gaza.
Yep.
Mosques, churches, civil offices, like government offices with records and just like, if that's not wiping out a civilization, I don't know what is.
Desecrating cemeteries, people's like past, their family history, all of that.
We just broke down the debate and Batya Unger Sargon made that comparison she said it's contradictory to say it's an ethnic cleansing and a genocide. Like it kind of contradicts itself. It's like, actually, no, it doesn't at all. They've killed 41,000 Palestinians while at the same time, a bunch that are stuck in Rafah, they want to push them through the Rafah border to set up a tent city in the Sinai Desert. It can both be an ethnic cleansing and a genocide. But to your point, I run into this too, where people are like, well, they haven't killed every single one of them.
Yeah.
It's like, that's convincing to you?
And they could. And it's like,
what are we talking about here?
They shouldn't kill anyone who's innocent, ideally, let alone like now over 35,000 that we know of.
The other language that you hear a lot, speaking to like the racism and the dehumanization, and there is a lot of like, post 9/11 vibes that are coming back as well, is this like, oh, well, the Israeli culture, and they're so advanced, and they're so, you know, the advanced technology and the medicine, this beautiful place, and then look at these barbarians in Gaza, and look at the way they live, and of course we're going to side with, you know, the, as Netanyahu says, the children of light over the children of darkness. And you see this also in, like, the Sam Harris's of the world, who want to make the, these arguments, or the Richard Dawkins of the world, who want to make these arguments that, like, Muslims are just inherently, culturally bad, barbaric, wrong, evil, uniquely so. And so, of course, we need to side with the Christians or the Jews over the Muslims.
They say they don't want the same things for their kids and their families that Christians do and that we do. That's what they say. Yeah. They don't want the same thing.
It's a horrible thing. I will, now that you mentioned Sam Harris, like, I don't know if you'll ever listen to this, but I was actually a big fan of Sam Harris, like, way back when, before he...
Way back in the day.
It was more when... It's a lot of his, like, mindfulness stuff and whatever. I found a lot of value in that. And then I, like, learned more about how he views Muslims and just, like, Jesus Christ, dude. Oh, my God.
It's a common story. There was a time when I liked him and, you know, then...
He's well-spoken and, like, seems, like, reasonable enough.
That tricks a lot of people. The way he does the NPR-style talking makes you think he's calm, cool, and collected and must be very rational with everything he's saying.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's his whole... Same thing with Dawkins, man. I freaking loved... Even his...
God Delusion was a good book, in my opinion.
But even before that, I loved his, like... He writes these, like, pop science books on evolution and whatever. I thought that, you know, that was so great. And
it's fascinating.
There's a number of people, I put Bill Maher in this camp too, that it turns out they're like Iraq, being on the right side of the Iraq war, like being against the Iraq war and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was just more like, ah, these Muslims, what are you going to do? They should all kill themselves, you know? It's astonishing the way that that has really come out. And at this point, it almost has to be, like, that Nazi ideology almost has to be so naked because there's no defending what's going on.
Without insane lies.
Outside of just out and out, like, Nazism. Yeah. And, you know, these are the bad guys. These are the good guys. They're inferior in all this various ways. And so they deserve, including their babies and their, you know, mothers and everything about them deserves to be destroyed.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, this might be controversial to say. I think it also starts with how, like, how they portray October 7th. And how they portray, like, Hamas as well, which, like, you know, I'm never going to sit here and ever try to justify the killing of innocent people. Because, like, I will mourn for every innocent civilian who was killed. Because at the end of the day, we're all people trying to go about our day, live our life. I think people really don't understand that, like, one, Palestinians have tried everything. We have tried everything. We had the Great March of Return, which was fully nonviolent, fully sort of like grassroots within Gaza. Like, it wasn't organized by any of the political factions there. We've tried sort of like God knows how many accords now, and we always get shafted. We always get dealt a very bad deal. And then the mainstream media here portrays it as, and I mean, they've been doing it with the ceasefire, where it's like, we want a permanent, lasting ceasefire and a promise that there will be a cessation of this, like, massacres and killing. And that is, like, a hard line. And they keep saying, like, oh,
Hamas rejected it. And
Hamas
it's like,
rejected
you're,
it.
You were proposing 6 weeks.
Yeah.
After and 6 weeks, going back to a genocide is not a ceasefire.
Exactly.
Right.
It's like, you want enough time for people to, like, forget about it in the media and whatever and, like, come back to
and
it.
And then reload.
Another thing that I really, like, I it would be wrong for me not to mention is, like, people don't understand that, one, Hamas is not just, like, this militant group. They're also, like, the government.
There's the political faction also. Yes. There's different wings.
So you're talking about, like, any sort of social welfare, any sort of governance. Like, it's also, like, there are politicians, people who've gotten, like, political science degrees and whatnot, like, who are part of the organization, who aren't necessarily part of the military wing or, like, involved in that area. And they are treated by the Israeli army as, like, equal to a guy who's also, shooting a gun in their face.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's like, that's not, there's, And that's the dehumanization of it. It's like everyone who even is remotely attached to this banner of Hamas is considered like wholly evil, unable to be reasoned with, like entirely insane. And it's like, that's not true. You have to be able to sit down with these people, and calling them just like violent, rampaging, barbaric terrorists, like that goes against any of that happening.
We've seen different stretches of different strategic approaches from Hamas as well. They always, people on the right and the Zionists always point out the thing in the charter about how, you know, they want to drive Israel into the sea or whatever. And but then there was also times where they said, look, we'll accept a 1960 deal along the 1967 borders. We'll accept that right now.
In fact, there is a report that I saw today that there was another indication from the political wing of exactly that.
I didn't see the source for that one. I saw the thing, but I didn't see the source for that one. Yeah. I'm not sure if that one's...
It was supposedly from Al Jazeera, but...
Oh, okay. That'd be legit.
We should check into this, but it was an indication that, you know, they had said, listen, we'll disband the military wing if we get a state along 67 borders.
Yeah.
And that's things that like that have been suggested in the past. Now, you could say, OK, well, they're not serious and they don't really mean it. And really, you know, the end goal is...
But by that logic, Likud is never serious.
Well, that,
right?
I mean, like, Likud is out and out not serious. Like, you want to talk about not a partner for peace.
Yeah.
They're very open about it. Netanyahu brags his whole gambit to hold on to power at this point, given his unpopularity, is to be the guy who's going to make sure that the Americans don't force a two-state solution on them.
I mean, you saw it just like, a week before October 7th or like a few weeks earlier, maybe he went to the UN and he had the map of Israel with no West Bank, no Gaza, no nothing. It's like,
yeah, and that was just accepted. Oh, this is fine.
Everyone
and good.
Was like, okay.
And the idea of like, and we've heard this a million times, like, oh, the war is not going to stop until we wipe out Hamas.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is setting an impossible standard on purpose to be able to continue to do this.
Precisely.
I mean, look, whether you call it Hamas or whatever the hell else you want to call it, you're creating more Palestinian hardline militants day by day by day. Because how many kids are now orphaned? How many innocent people did you kill? What do you think their surviving family members are going to do? Yeah. They're immediately going to, they're going to go join the local faction like that. If I was in that position, are you kidding me? I'd be like, go give me an AK-47. I'll go sign up right now. There was a very viral video going around of this kid, probably 13, 14 years old, screaming at Netanyahu, saying, I'm coming for you. You took everything. My whole family just got killed.
And that is actually how a bulk of the people end up being sort of indoctrinated into the militant side.
Of course.
Hamas.
Yeah.
I think even, God, I wish I could remember the name, but there was this podcast, I think, by CSIS. Like, they have their podcast, and there was like a former State Department official on it who confirmed from his own time in the State Department, and he said that at least 40% of those people on the ground fighting for Hamas are orphans.
Right.
You have no other choice. You grow up as like this very young, sort of malleable, easy to indoctrinate kid. And above that, by the way, your parents were killed by this military, as were a few of your aunts, your cousins, maybe your siblings. You either can, you know, just sit and do nothing about it, or how about here's a weapon. Take up arms and go fight.
Yes. Or organize the Great March of Return and get
and
sniped by IDF.
So what do you, that's the point, is like, what do you think is going to happen in these, you put people in these impossible situations and then the logical reaction happens and then it's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spare me.
Again, that's not to excuse like killing of innocent civilians. I will never say that that's an okay thing to do. It's more so to give context of like, the Palestinians have tried everything, and a lot of the people who are taking up arms, I mean, you can go on YouTube and there are a few channels of people, mostly on the West Bank, of people interviewing guys who have joined some of the brigades in like Jenin or whatever in the West Bank. And it's a very common story.
Right.
They killed my brother.
Yeah.
I was an engineer and they killed my brother and then they killed my aunt.
Yeah.
How dare they?
And also, you know, there's a lot of crocodile tears, too, because the fact of the matter is, I've gone through the numbers extensively on my show, but depending on which numbers you believe, it's anywhere from 55% to 70% of the people killed by Hamas on October 7th were innocent civilians. Mm-hmm. And that's horrible. That's condemnable. I'm with that all the way. Mm-hmm. Israel killed 92% innocent civilians, mm-hmm. right? It's higher mm-hmm. as a percentage and it's higher as a raw number.
Yeah.
So look, you want to play the game where we're using labels, you want to call Hamas terrorists, I'm right there with you. But you also got to call the IDF terrorists. You also got to call the IDF terrorists.
Correct.
And they don't, nobody's giving me a good reaction to that when I point that out.
Yeah.
It's nobody's like, yeah, you're right. The IDF are terrorists. They go, oh no, the IDF didn't mean it. And their intentions are good. And it's like, let's not do this.
So they're starving the entire population.
Yes.
How can your intentions be good?
But Hamas. That's my reaction. That's what you hear, right?
Yeah.
Hamas, bro.
I don't know if you saw this recently, but I think Al Jazeera and other places have done reporting on they're using like these quadcopters now that are emitting sounds of either like cries of children
or
women screaming so that people run out and help.
And then they kill them.
They shoot.
I got one more video. For you, your work. This is directly related to the starvation as a weapon of war, and you're confronting Senator Marco Rubio. Let's take a look at this one.
Are you willing to call on our Israeli allies to open up the borders so that they let the aid in?
Not unless
is the most efficient way, the most quick and efficient way.
But the only way that they can do it is that they can ensure that none of that aid, that weapons and other things are being embedded in the aid, as has been done consistently throughout the years. If someone can figure out a way to do that, and maybe this port thing is the way to do it, I'm all for it.
The port is inefficient. They're murdering civilians. They're starving the population.
No, Hamas should surrender.
You cannot, sir. Hamas, it's not justified.
You're taping this, right?
Correct.
Hamas should surrender so that the people there could stop suffering because of them. It's all Hamas.
Sir, this is not true. It does not.
If Hamas lays down their weapons, the fighting stops.
That does not justify 32,000 dead, a starvation, a famine.
That's a lie.
Sir, no, you are lying right now. You are lying. You're supporting genocide.
So you've got a whole plethora of standard talking points there. Mm-hmm. First of all, you hear at the end, he's accusing you of being pro-Hamas.
Mm-hmm. Won't even let the aid in.
And he's, denying the reality of the death toll, which we all know is actually much higher than the official numbers that are coming out, because, you know, that oftentimes doesn't count. Those who are lost who are under the rubble, those who are lost and missing, etc. So God only knows what the actual death number is at this point. And then, you know, to your questions about, hey, well, people are starving to death. Like, shouldn't something be done about that? They just need to open the border. Shouldn't you ask them to do that? He's like, well, Hamas should just lay down their arms.
Mm-hmm.
So they're holding the entire population hostage.
Correct.
Try to compel Hamas to lay down their arms.
Yeah. And it's an excuse that's used to just continue what Israel is doing to the population. It's all, I mean, I joke with my friends. I mean, if Hamas was as incredible and efficient an organization as they make it out to be, that their propaganda like penetrates through every media platform and they've convinced the whole world and they've infiltrated the UN, and at times Biden is apparently
in
Hamas's camp. I'm like, you would think they would have freed Palestine at this point.
Right.
They had that kind of power.
I mean, everything is Hamas now. Or Iran, now that's what they're switching to.
That's right.
So there's this zombie lie floating around, which drives me crazy. And Rubio kind of alluded to it there. The idea that, like, we can't let the aid in because the aid is getting stolen. Mm-hmm. It's going on to Hamas. And there's 30,000 Hamas members. There's 2.3 million, or at least there were 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, and I've heard this a million times, oh, Hamas is stealing all the aid and that's the real problem. Practically, logically, all of that aid... 30,000 people, 2.3 million in Gaza. They can't even if they wanted to do that, they can't hoard all that.
The part I liked is he suggests like, oh, well, they might be like, there might be weapons in that aid that goes to Hamas. Some of that aid is from us.
Yeah.
So like, are we secretly shipping weapons to Hamas? Is that a serious concern of yours?
I haven't seen any credible reporting on Hamas infiltrating aid convoys or anything. I'd love to be corrected, but I've never seen it. So.
But we have seen the IDF turning around aid trucks early on, and 70% of the aid trucks were being turned around, because what they would do is stop the truck, unload everything, which is a delay tactic, by the way. Mm-hmm. They unload everything. Then if there's one thing on the truck that they don't like, they turn it around. And oftentimes what happened is they would send in tents, and the tents would have to be created with these poles. And they would say those poles could theoretically, hypothetically, eventually maybe be used for weapons. So we're going to turn the whole truck around, even if it's 95% food, turn the whole thing around. And they were blocking 70% of the aid. And that's the old number. Then the ICJ stepped in and said, you got to allow in all this. Then they didn't allow in all of it, right? And it's
I think they got more restrictive.
After
the ICJ. That's
and so where are we now? Yeah. We're watching a literal starvation campaign is what we're doing.
You mentioned Iran. The last thing I wanted to get from you is, you know, they're making a big push. So I very much think that the Israeli escalation, you know, bombing Iran's embassy, which is outrageous, and then obviously Iran is going to retaliate. And now we're talking about Iran versus talking about the humanitarian suffering in Gaza. If you're looking at mainstream media, now there's this big push to get this massive Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan foreign aid package. Do you have any sense from your conversations of how some of the more, you know, the Democrats, like Chris Van Hollen, for example, who've been rhetorically better with regards to Palestinians? Do you have any sense of how they're thinking about this giant aid package they're trying to shove through?
I think, I mean, based on my experiences with them and my interactions and engaging with a lot of their staffers and the representatives themselves or the senators, we've, like, this current package, which, by the way, increased the money sent to Israel. It's now $26.38 billion. I think the initial number, what passed through the Senate, was 14. Then they wanted to propose one that had 18, and now we're at 26. So it keeps increasing. And I think this is a testament to, like, the flawed nature of our Congress and, like, the way bills are passed and structured even. One of the biggest pieces of pushback we've had when we've talked to staffers is, but what about Ukraine? And I think, I'm trying to remember, Jim Costa is his name. He's a congressman from California. He, one time, like, I was telling him, you know, we were talking about the you know, there's over like 13,000 kids dead, and please, like, no more weapons to Israel until they stop this, their massacres. And he got very weirdly, like, defensive and aggressive, and, like, got up right in my face and said, what about the kids in Ukraine? And I was like, I didn't say anything about the kids in Ukraine.
Right.
I'm just telling you.
Like, you guys are putting it together, not me.
Yeah, like, right? He got up in my face saying, like, what about the kids in Ukraine? I'm like, I didn't say a word about Ukraine. I'm telling you here, I'm Palestinian American. There's any more weapons to this nation of Israel is going to go towards killing more of my family and children in Gaza. And their defense, I mean, that's an extreme example, but I've had, like, James McGovern, for example. That's a, we spoke for a lengthy period of time with James McGovern himself, who's supposedly progressive, and, like, his voting record in terms of, like, he voted against the I think he voted against the UNRWA defunding. So he was against UNRWA being defunded. He voted he has a pretty decent voting record, all things considered, and his rhetoric about Palestine is, relative to most people in Congress, pretty good.
Right.
When we talked to him about just, like, a hard line, because with Code Pink, we have a list of people who just, like, hard no to any weapons to Israel, no matter how it's packaged. And when we tried to get him on that, he said, look, if something comes in and it also has aid for Ukraine, I'm going to have to vote for it. And so, like, it's almost like our government holding, like, weirdly holding themselves, but also us as the people they're supposed to represent, hostage, as, like, well, if you don't want this, too bad, because we got to do this. And it's like,
I had
that's
read
not
that,
how it should be.
I had read that Johnson was splitting the two to one Israel vote,
that's,
one Ukraine
that's
vote.
That's what we thought, too.
That's what you thought, too?
I mean, this stuff changes by the hour.
Right.
I'm on Punchbowl News, like, all the time, like, trying to figure out what's going on.
So the thing that passed through the Senate was everything together.
Yes.
Through the House, they couldn't make that work because you have too many Republicans who don't want the Ukraine aid.
Yeah.
And then you have some number of Democrats who don't want the Israel aid.
Correct.
But you have a majority in the House that would vote for Ukraine. You got enough Republicans and Democrats. All the Democrats vote for the Ukraine aid. And then if you take all the Republicans and the remaining Democrats vote for the Israel aid, then that will get through. And then they've also got the Taiwan one. And then they've got this banned TikTok and whatever the hell else is in the fourth bill.
If that gets in there, that's...
So they're insane. They're planning to pass all four of them separately and then put them all together.
Yeah.
Basically like in conference with the Senate is my understanding.
That's,
and so it's kind of a... It's kind of a legislative trick to be able to get this through.
Yes.
And also it requires Democrats to vote along with the Republicans on the what's called the rules package. I mean, this is all very technical and whatever, but that's a break with what is normally done procedurally. Usually the Democrats don't help the Republicans in terms of getting those rules packages through. But when it comes to sending our tax dollars to bomb babies, well, then they're going to do what they need to do.
Foreign wars are the most like bipartisan
agreement
you will see. And it's actually, I'm glad you mentioned that because a lot of the, we go to a lot of hearings either to like, I mean, our focus is Palestine and Gaza. And, but we go to a lot of hearings that are to do with like, not now a lot, like they had a lot this week about Iran. And it's, I've gotten to see like just how scary our Congress is, because some of those hearings, like for example, yesterday there was the anti-Semitism hearing, the third one, and that had a lot of media coverage and people knew of it. And like, I was with a group of students from Columbia who wanted to go there and talk about like what went down in Columbia in terms of the suppression of Palestinians and the chemical incident 90 days ago now. But then we went to this other hearing that was barely attended, no media, and the whole hearing was, I think the witnesses were all just like people from the State Department or Department of Defense and like Assistant Secretary, whoever the heck. And it's just like this, like Democrats and Republicans are all like, they were like laughing with each other, like, I'm so glad we have this bipartisan agreement that Iran is horrible and we need to like do whatever we can to sanction them. And it was just like, wow, this is the terrifying core of our Congress.
That's right.
Just like these sincerely boring hearings of just like warmongers. Like the whole thing was like a warmongering.
And they're also fucking idiots. They also don't know anything.
Oh, that's they the other.
I mean, could you imagine trying to get the history of Iran from one of those? Like, go ahead, tell me about the 1979 revolution. Tell me about that. Tell me about the Shah.
Yeah.
Tell me about Mohammed Mossadegh. Like these people, they probably don't know anything about any of that.
Mike Johnson just rolled back out the axis of evil terminology.
Great. That's good.
I mean, I'm like,
good stuff. Good
right.
Stuff.
It's unreal. But I mean, God bless you for being in there.
I'll tell you just to this point about the Iran thing, about just like how incompetent they are. This is also this, I think his name is Scott McCormick, the Georgia congressman. We have like one of our conversations with him was a few days ago. We never put this up because we're like, this guy is just like, this is not even worth our effort to put up. We asked him about like his, as usual, his thoughts about sending more weapons to Israel. He says his whole thing now is like, just like Iran is a bad actor. And my friend Julia, who's in a lot of the videos, she's the quiet like face of our movement. She asks him this very valid question of like, but you're aware that they like hit the embassy in Damascus, killing like a general, a high level general, and like these other members of their of the IRGC. And he like squints and he's like, yeah, you know, I'm not so sure. Like I like they hit them in Syria. I'm like, yes, the embassy.
Oh my God.
And he like looks at us and he's like, you know, like I don't get into all that. They need to figure that out. But I'll tell you what I know. Iran's a bad actor.
Oh,
and like literally, like Julia and I are like laughing, while talking to him because we're like, dude, are you serious?
You should maybe post that because that's astonishing. You should maybe post that.
I might.
Because
I don't want to give him any, like...
But honestly, I would have predicted that. I would have predicted that everybody would pretend like Iran was acting aggressively, even though they 100% did not.
Yeah.
That Israel attacked first.
How many times did I hear? Unprovoked attack.
Unprovoked.
Like, can you imagine what we would do if our embassy got in some of our top military?
Oh. It's game over.
You know, John Kirby or whoever got taken out, Lloyd Austin. Can you imagine?
Whoever did it, enjoy your coup. Enjoy.
Right.
As we always say, Israel is the King Joffrey of countries.
Yep.
They are massive, massive cry bullies. That's what they are.
Yes.
Tell everybody where they can find you, your social media accounts, all that
of
stuff.
Of course. My main social media account is on Instagram. It's at TazSDC. It's at TAZSDC. I would also suggest you follow at Code Pink Alert. I'm with them every day in Congress. We confront Congress people, senators, as you saw in some of the videos here. We do a lot of disruptions. We disrupted Lloyd Austin yesterday as well as last week. Talk about heartless, sort of robotic people. And yeah, that's sort of the main thing.
You got to let us know if there's an uptick of anybody coming, because we had Medea on last week and we posted a clip telling people to meet you guys wherever you guys meet.
Yeah, she said, what is it, 10 a.m. Rayburn?
10 a.m. Rayburn Cafeteria, Monday through Friday, every week.
So if you want to help stop the genocide.
You too can go and hang out with Brian Mast.
I will say, just to add to that, people like... Because we've told people that before, and there's still the sort of fear of, like, you can just walk in, and it's literally that simple. You just walk in, there's very basic security, you put your things through the thing, go through a metal detector, and you are in. And then we can really confront our representative.
Yeah, well,
and you're doing God's work.
And you can just ask the, you know, security up front, where's the cafeteria?
They're
very helpful. So, it's not actually intimidating once you get there.
If I can just say one last thing, I would really urge you to join us, because I will say this as someone who's Arab, who's Arab-American. We knew, like, I grew up in the Middle East. I grew up in Kuwait most of my life. And we know, especially as Arabs, as people who have been subject to a lot of the U.S. military's imperial aggression and what have you, I felt like I had a good idea of, like, how awful some of these people in Congress would be.
Mm.
It's worse than I thought.
Wow.
It's sincerely, sincerely worse than, like, the most, like, egregious, comical version, evil version of them I could have imagined. It's worse. And that's why we need you to join us.
Wow.
All right. You guys heard it here. Thank you so much for joining us, Monkey.
Yeah.
We appreciate it.
Great to get to chat with you again.